This is WGNS Action Line, talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you. Now, your host, Scott Walker.
With us in studio from Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue, we have Fire Marshal Brian Lowe. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Scott.
This past weekend, we had, of course, July 4th. Did you guys have a lot of phone calls?
We had some phone calls. Not as many fires as we'd had last year. I think if you recall, last time I was here, my number was zero. I wanted to have zero fires from, fireworks. After the fireworks, people putting fireworks in the trash, but we only had one. But the good news is I don't think that family was displaced, so it damaged the siding and got into the attic, but fire crews managed to get it out really quick. So,
and that was a case where somebody threw away fireworks that weren't quite burned out yet, I guess?
That's correct. So a lot of times when we shoot those fireworks in the front yard, and we're just trying to be good neighbors and get everything packed up and cleaned up. Sometimes there's hot fire brands and embers still in those boxes, we get them all in a trash can. They can find a way to get out. So,
hey, yeah. How long should we let them burn out? Because I know people will still be shooting off fireworks tonight, even though they're probably not supposed to.
Well, it's going to happen. You're not supposed to, right? That was third through the fifth. But I would say if you're shooting third, fourth, and fifth, you're shooting fireworks, just let them set out overnight. Put them in a bucket of water for a few hours and just collect them the next morning. That's the safest thing to do. So,
did you guys have any calls for, emergency response for somebody who got injured from fireworks?
I don't know that. I was just typically when they are briefing me, it's just about fires. Today, I will get more on that as far as the reports go.
Did y'all have any, and I'm sure you calculate this too, any fires caused by fireworks, the days leading up to the 4th of July?
Not that I recall.
Pretty tame then. That's good.
It's been a good year.
And as of, yesterday, the day before, the firework tents should all be closed. Were they allowed to sell one more day after?
I believe 4th? July the 5th. They're allowed to kind of clean that up. Yeah.
So they
put all the sales on.
In fact, I know I already drove past a couple this morning. Looks like they were totally empty inside.
Yes, sir. The tent may be there, but should be tables and fireworks should be gone. Yeah.
I wonder how many fireworks these places sell, because it seems like there's fewer and fewer fireworks being seen in neighborhoods as opposed to years past. At least I didn't see as many like this year compared to last year even.
Okay. Oh, well, that's a good question. We actually had that discussion. I thought, well, since the 4th was on Friday this year, we actually brought it up that maybe they did a little bit better this year as far as the sales go. But I don't know. It's, we actually inspected 13 tents inside the city, so that was a good number for us.
Hey, I know. I saw there were a lot of neighborhoods that had pretty big fireworks. I mean, pretty impressive fireworks. It looked almost commercial-like.
Yeah. Occasionally, we'll get requests for neighborhood or block parties. And if they are wanting to block off a street, they have to go through the city and get that permit, or through the special events request through Parks and Rec to get that, just so we can put eyes on it, make sure they're not blocking the street. But, yeah. Fireworks are supposed to be shot off on private property, not in the street, but those residential fireworks can be upwards of 1 inch, 1.75 inches, and I think anything over that is going to be considered commercial.
Some neighborhoods, mm-hmm. I guess, have little planned parties and everything.
Absolutely. Yep.
It makes sense. Yep. And then in the immediate area, I know there were a lot of fireworks shows, everywhere from Smyrna to Nashville and out on the lake as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody was getting involved.
So what else happens this time of year? What is the fire department typically seeing as far as fires go this time of year?
We've had a lot of rain, so typically we see our brush and grass fires go up. But right now we're just real steady house fires, maybe get one or two a week.
And we're expecting, I guess, more rain throughout this week as well, so there's always the possibility of flooding.
Always a possibility. I think, rain's music to my ears, not too much, right? But I think just from what I'm seeing, the patterns are, hot during the day, and then those storms build up for the afternoons and maybe scattered.
Do we have a lot of, flash flooding? I know we have flash flooding warnings on occasion, but do we have a lot of flash flooding here in our area?
Well, there's potential. There's certain areas in town when we do get those deluges or those heavy rainstorms. One that comes to mind is Memorial right there, where you wouldn't think it would. I've gone through there on some heavy rains and right there in front of, I guess, the Stones River Nissan right in that area. It seems like rain will get up on the road, and even on Broad Street, there's some areas that we got to be careful of. So yeah, there's potential for it.
And of course, you always seems like at least you hear about a motorist that tries to drive through an area that they think is not very deep. Next thing you know, they get stuck. What is the common thought there? I mean, are you not supposed to drive through if it appears to be over an inch deep, or what is the word of caution?
Well, I would say if you can't see where you're going, don't drive. Just turn around, go the other way. We have several areas on the fringes. One comes to mind is Armstrong Valley, where there's some areas there that a pond will get up over the road, and that's still water, but the creek, that creek that runs along Armstrong Valley will actually cross in a couple places, and it's actually moving, and it don't take much of running water to move your car off the road surface.
Of course, so. We have a couple of little bridges that are like slabs, and those are the areas that I see really flooding.
Yeah, folks get there, and they just don't. They don't want to take the time to turn around. They want to chance it. But yeah, I would say if water's moving over the bridge, over the slab, don't try it. Just turn around and go the other way. So.
Because I guess all that happens pretty quick. I mean, if you get stuck in that, if your car is pushed by the current, that happens fast. What usually does occur? Does it flip over or what?
I guess it could flip depending on the terrain or the creek bed. But, most cars will float for a time and get off in the in that creek channel, river channel, whatever, wherever they're at, but they won't float long. And we've actually pulled people off the top of cars before.
Whenever those types of things occur, or when there's a rescue involving where you're pulling a vehicle out of the water, maybe the river or even the lake in some situations, I guess for those who live by Percy Priest. Mm-hmm. But when those situations occur, does your office go in and investigate that just like they would a fire?
No, we don't do that. We'll leave that to PD, I guess, and maybe they'll treat that as a, I would say they would treat that as a wreck, I would say. I don't know. I've never asked that question, but we don't, we don't typically pull the cars out. We're focused on life safety. Those swift water teams, they're going to get their boats out, and they're going to get the person away from the car, and that car will just be there until the water goes down, until someone, maybe a recovery truck can get out and get it. So, yeah.
Now, when it comes to homes, garages, and things like that, are there things that we need to be more cautious of, and are materials today more flammable than what they once were?
Not necessarily. When you ask material, you're talking about building materials or maybe wall surface covers?
Yeah, everything from building materials to, just the furniture, the furnishings that we have in our house.
40 years ago, we called that legacy construction, right? So newer construction, yes, has more glues in it, and it's we see more laminate, more in the construction today, glues and trusses are not necessarily hand cut anymore. They may be prefab, and even furniture with the styrofoams and all the petroleum products in it will it can be hazard if it catches fire. But there is those industries have come a long ways with the flame spread as far as on that furniture, trying to prevent, if a loose match or candle got away to, if it turned over on the couch, to just keep from burning up instantly.
When you look at different pieces of furniture, materials like leather versus, just a traditional fabric, do leathers not burn as fast, or do they burn faster than just that traditional fabric?
Well, I wouldn't say leathers would burn faster than fabric. I think it depends on how long they're exposed to a flame, right? Anything like that will burn if it's exposed to a flame long enough. It's going to start to propagate across and heat up and essentially catch fire.
Last time you were on the air, we talked a little bit about arson cases, and I do think it's kind of surprising when you do hear about an arson, but those definitely still happen right here in our community.
They do. That's correct. Yeah.
But it's, or is it easier to locate the source of where that fire started, with new technology? I don't know if you have technology that helps you to recognize certain things, but is it easier to investigate and figure out where this fire started and how?
The fire will tell you where it started. So we look at char, depth of char, and typically the longer something burns, the more damage. So there's going to be, if you have a, you know, start a fire on one end of a piece of wood and it goes to the other, obviously the end you started on is going to have more damage than the end that it was traveling to. So, you know, the investigators, they're going to work from the unburned portions of the house to the more burned or more heavily damaged portions of the house to locate that origin. And then we'll get into the cause. But there are resources out there for us as far as finding things that maybe someone may have used to start a fire, like TBI. They have arson dogs that we can call in, and just like a drug sniffing dog, they come in and that's their thing. They look for ignitable liquids.
That's interesting. I didn't even realize that. So if TBI gets involved, they will literally bring dogs out there to figure out, are they figuring out where the fire first came from and then what smell to look for or smell?
Well, I guess that dog's looking for ignitable liquid. I'm not sure if it's where the fire first came from, but they can tell you, hey, something's in this area that shouldn't be here.
That's fascinating. And then as far as technology goes, are there different things to, you know, detect, all right, well, this fire in particular was started with, you know, X liquid?
Not necessarily. The TBI lab that we also use, you know, we lean on TBI quite a bit, but they can, some of the tests that they run will look for ignitable liquids. And then it just comes down to the old olfactory senses. You know, what did we smell or see when we were in the house, and what can we associate that with? Gas, kerosene, or other ignitable liquids.
Are you ever surprised at the outcome of an investigation, or maybe in the middle of an investigation, you're surprised to figure out what caused this fire or who caused this fire?
Well, when we say surprise, so we go in, all the investigators, they're going to go into every fire looking for every potential ignition source and treating it like it's a crime until they don't have to. I guess a surprise sometimes would be something small that, you know, you wouldn't expect to be there.
Is there a basic cause for the majority of fires? Like, let's say in homes, are most caused by electrical issues, wiring issues?
I would say the number one cause would be unattended cooking. There are some electrical issues that we see on occasion, but most fires, apartments and residential, will be unattended cooking. So it's folks just putting something on the stove and either getting distracted or walking away. So
I know every year we hear lots of information about deep frying turkeys, and that's one of those things that you always hear. You know, they start fires. People put the turkey in, the hot grease comes out, and so forth.
Yeah,
but that still happens too.
Yeah, now it does. I don't think we had one this last year. I didn't look for that before I come up here. But I can recall a few over the years where we would have fryers on decks, and if you know, the warnings are out there when you're deep frying your turkey to either measure that the oil before you get going, or don't put a wet or frozen turkey into the oil. So we still have folks doing that, and if that oil leaves that container hot, obviously that open flame, it's going to catch, and if you're on a wooden deck, it doesn't go well together, and so if that deck catches fire, it's going to get to the house.
Yeah,
it happens.
It looks a little scary, you know. Yeah. A little shaky.
Yeah, it is. So yeah. But five gallons of peanut oil is pretty scary when it's boiling. So yeah,
that's a lot of oil that can do a lot of damage, I'd say. And then in garages, are car fires, you know, somebody working on their car, is that typically what sets off fires in garages?
We've had a few over the years where it may have been just I can't say if it was people working on it or what it was, but we've had a few car fires where failure of equipment or something like that, if someone just had some work done, and it somehow found an ignition source or the fuel and the, you know, heat, all, everything came together and perfect, and they parked in the garage and it just caught fire.
In recent months, have we had any fires that, you know, you've had to do investigative work on to determine what caused the fire?
Yes, sir. Well, every fire we have, we're going to do an investigation on it. It may be left up to that captain or that battalion chief to make sure that's completed. But if they can't make that determination, then they engage the fire marshal office team, where one of our investigators will show up. And we've had several where we, show up and really just dig into it.
And so whenever those fire investigations are conducted, do you guys send a report? Of course, I guess a report stays with the fire department itself, or they submit it to the state. How does that work? Because I know insurance comes into play there at some point, and the person's insurance will have to find out what happened.
Yeah. So we have our report our incident report that our crews will fill out, but then there's supplemental reports that our investigators will complete. And if they complete them, if they can find the origin and cause and they can close it out, then it will be part of that report. But if it's undetermined, if it's ongoing, it will not be part of that report, but it will be available to the insurance companies, or even if it goes through any kind of litigation, it will, they can request those reports. So, and our investigators will work with those reporters. So, private investigators.
What are those steps that you go through whenever there is a fire call? I mean, obviously a fire department goes out there to put the fire out first, but mm-hmm. what are those steps that occur next?
For the homeowner?
For your department, the fire marshal's office, when they go out there, what are they doing once they arrive on the scene?
Okay. All right. Good question. So yeah, once the investigators arrive on the scene, they are typically, things are still going on, right? So they are letting those crews essentially wrap that scene up, get things cooled off and put the fire out, and to where that space is tenable, or we can get inside that to start looking around. And while they're doing that, those investigators, they're going to be out either knocking on doors, talking to neighbors. Hey, what'd you see? If the homeowner's there, what was going on at the time of this fire? And a lot of times that's how we determine you know, what started that fire, is what that homeowner was doing at the time of the fire. And for example, hey, I was cooking and I walked away from it, or I had this this going on over here in the corner, or I had a candle burning here in this area. And if, you know, if that's consistent with where that fire, the origin of that fire is, a lot of times that's how we get to determine the cause. But as those crews, the operational crews, move out of the structure, that's when we move in. And those investigators may have some questions for the incident command, or even the crews who made first entry into that the house, for example. Hey, did you have to break the door in, or was it open? Just some simple things like that that'll help us start rebuilding what was there.
And so those questions that are asked to the homeowner, are those usually done that day, you know, the day of the fire?
They can be that day. Sometimes we have follow-up questions where we may come back and ask questions later. So yeah,
and things like leaving a candle unattended, I know that is easy to do, especially around the holidays, Christmas especially, people leave candles burning, but are those a big cause of fires here locally?
They can be, yes. We've had plenty of candles to start fires here, and folks, a lot of candle to, you know, just improve the smell of a room, or just to have one burning. And if it finds a light combustible or something that's easily ignited, then it don't take much to start a fire. So,
so usually, I guess a candle has to be next to something for it to catch on fire,
yes,
as opposed
correct.
To just sitting on an open table.
Yeah, that's correct.
The bottom line, I guess, yeah. You should leave the candles burning.
Candles are relatively safe, right? Especially if they're the flames protected. But if you're placing your candles in an area where there's a lot of light combustibles, like paper or paper towels, or just an area where they may come into contact with stuff like that, there's potential that they will find that ignition or that fuel to keep burning.
Of course, this time of year, a lot of people are cooking out. They have maybe even campfires or some type of fire out back. Mm-hmm. What are the common dangers with not only cooking out, but having some type of fire behind their house? Maybe it's in a little rock area formation that they make. But what are the dangers there?
Well, dangers are really how you start the fire. Just be sure to start that with kindling or light paper. Do not use ignitable liquids, because gasoline can get away from you. The fumes from that can be volatile, and they'll travel away from the air you pour it if you don't light it right away. But just don't use, just a good practice not to use ignitable liquids for your fires. But mainly what we want people to know on those outdoor fires is keep them away from the house. You know, if it's a little campfire, a little 3x3, you need to be at least 25 feet away from your house. Bigger fires, like if you're cleaning brush, those you need to be 50 feet away from really any structure, a fence or your house. And have a garden hose or water, something nearby, a bucket of water, something ready to put it out if need be.
Can people still burn brush if they're in the city limits? Can you burn brush in your backyard?
Absolutely, if you have the area to do it. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, you can burn brush, or you can place it out by the street for our city teams to pick up. And I would say, if you do that, if you have a hydrant in your yard, please do not pile the brush around the fire hydrant or block that area in front of the fire hydrant. We've had some of that here this year that we've had to address. Folks just cleaning up trees and stuff, and really just cleaning up the yard and placing them out by the street, but they're blocking some hydrants. So
now, how often is there going to be a hydrant to every, I don't know, let's say 4 or 5 houses? Is there a specific number whenever a builder goes in to build a neighborhood?
Yeah, hey, that's a good question. That's something I do every week. So yeah, our hydrants, our spacing is about 500 feet from hydrant to hydrant. So we don't want any house to be more than 250 feet away from a hydrant. So if you're right in the middle, if you come to the end of your driveway, you should be able to turn left or right and within 250 feet be at a hydrant. So and typically when I'm looking at neighborhood plans or new neighborhoods coming in, I will ask them to set a hydrant at the entrance of that neighborhood, and that be the base, and then from there we work away from that at every 500 feet or 250 feet away from a structure.
And then how do you ensure there's enough water pressure there to actually go through the lines to put out a fire?
Well, that's where I rely on my friends over at CUD and Murfreesboro Water to give us those figures. We flow the hydrants annually to make sure, one, the water's there, but also we work close with Murfreesboro Water and CUD to make sure that we can build those houses.
And then whenever we see a fire department stopping at a hydrant to let off water, what is it they're doing there?
Well, sometimes they are just flushing, but sometimes they are actually capturing the static and the residual flow of that hydrant, and that will tell us how much water we're getting from that hydrant.
And is that water that's coming through those hydrants, is it the same water that goes through the water treatment plant and then comes out, of course, in our sinks?
Yes, sir. It's the same water that we have stored in our tanks in the city, yes.
Now, years ago, we'd hear stories about a fire department coming out to fill up somebody's swimming pool. That doesn't happen that I know of anymore, does it?
No, sir. We do not do that. Now, I think you, I don't want to speak for them, but you may be able to work with the water department to maybe rent a meter, and they might be able to help you on that. But yeah, that's something we do not do. So
I don't know if that was something, a story that was told many times in the 70s or 60s, yeah, or what, but I know I heard, yeah, that before years ago.
Well, it's a common question. Hey, we all come from a pool, but I think it's more in jest, but no, that was a little bit before my time. So
yeah. How much water actually goes through there? I mean, when you hook to a hydrant, how much is coming out?
Well, it depends. Say if we have one engine company and they're flowing one hand line, that's about, 250 GPM. But now one engine company, they have 1,500 GPM pumps on them. So depending on what size of tip they have, or they're using some of our solid stream or smooth bore tips on top of that truck, what we call master streams, they're going to be upwards of 1,000 gallons a minute. So
that's a lot.
It's a lot of water. It adds up.
I can, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you think about a gallon and then 1,000 of them right there per minute, that, mm-hmm, that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, and you can imagine if we have 2 or 3 trucks or fire engines working on a scene, it can add up quick. So
in that topic of new neighborhoods, new subdivisions, because we're getting a lot of them, we have gotten a lot of them over the years, do you ever have to go in and say, well, you know, you're going to have to add an extra hydrant here in order for all these houses to be reached by the fire department?
Yeah, so on the new subdivisions, I have some input on that on the front end, and we can, so it's built into that. Occasionally, we're, you know, in the older parts of town before we had adopted codes and the hydrants aren't as close, I have when I know a new project's coming in, I have to keep an eye on it, make sure the hydrants are within that range that we like. So
have you had to go in and kind of retrofit certain areas?
I have, sure have. Let's see, you know, Vine Street, I think, we have several projects within what I would call the downtown area that have needed some hydrants. And so what we look for is, one, is that hydrant within, will we be able to service that structure with the existing? Do we need to add a hydrant? But also thoroughfares. We don't want to block main thoroughfares with a hydrant. If we don't have a hydrant on our side of the street and it's going to block a main road, we don't want to shut down main roads to, if we can keep from it, to fight a fire or to at least service a property. So
Is your office also going out to do different types of inspections, let's say commercially, for a new business that's just built?
Yes, absolutely. So those would be called our C of O inspections or our final inspections. We work with building codes, the building codes department, and other departments to make sure that when those new occupancies or buildings are built, that they have everything, all the features, fire department features, and everything's intact, life safety. Yes, sir. We have inspectors going out every day. That's that one of the primary jobs of our assistant fire marshals, or two assistant fire marshals handle that, where the inspectors, they do most of the annual inspections. But yes, that stuff is happening each week.
Now, so, while sprinkler systems are not required for just homes throughout the area, are they required for commercial businesses?
Well, it depends. Size of the building, square foot, what are they wanting to do inside that structure. You know, some of them assemblies, depending on like a nightclub, anywhere that serves alcohol, food. Yeah, if you get over a certain square foot where your occupant load's going to be over 99, it's going to require a sprinkler system. Yeah.
And with a sprinkler system in place, how quickly are those able to act if there is a fire inside a commercial building?
Well, I think what we've seen in sprinkler systems, if that fire is, you know, if the sprinkler heads are installed correctly and the design has them spread out the way they should, those sprinkler heads usually work within 2 to 3 minutes of that heat starting to build up. And so, you know, typically it takes 1 to 2 sprinkler heads to control the fire. Most of the times it's just one. It's usually the head in the area of where that fire origin where the fire originated. And that, a lot of times that one sprinkler head will cool it off enough, and it'll usually fill the building up with smoke, but it'll keep the fire down. And the fire crews will move in and make sure that fire's out and control that water. So, yeah.
So is that sprinkler system, that the head of the sprinkler, is that reusable, or is it something that is usually messed up because of a fire, or how does that usually, I guess, unfold?
Yeah, so it's one and done. It's just like any other plumbing fixture. They can screw it out. Each sprinkler system, each building fitted with a sprinkler system, also has a box with extra sprinkler heads. Now, the maintenance men of that facility, they can plug a new one in, but in order to get that system back on, they have to have a licensed sprinkler contractor to come in and make sure everything's on the up and up, and they can tag that system as in service. So
there's a lot that goes into all of that.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it.
So. And then as far as, you know, the actual fire extinguisher within different businesses, do those have to be inspected X amount of months out of the year?
Well, annually. So once a year, the, you know, fire extinguishers on the wall, a company will come in and tag them and make sure they are, one, that powder is not settled on the bottom, and two, to make sure that they are charged and ready.
How do you determine that? Because, I mean, it's a sealed device, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm not an extinguisher tech, but I can tell you I've watched them a time or two, and they'll turn it over, and they can feel that powder move. And it is a sealed device. It's a cylinder. So it's just like any other steel cylinder. They'll have to take it apart. Like, I think it's every 5 years to get a visual on the inside to make sure things are still good. And then they'll put it back together. For the most part, that's good enough. They usually work when you grab them. So, yeah.
That's all we need them to do.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah.
Brian Lowe is with us today from Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue with the Fire Marshal's Office. We're going to take a short break, and then we will be right back. Stay with us.
Are you tired of constantly spending money on sprays and other things to control mosquitoes around your home? If so, come by Holden Hardware and get the Spartan Mosquito Eradicators. When used properly, the Spartan Mosquito Eradicators will kill mosquitoes. Come by Holden Hardware on the square and get the Spartan Mosquito Eradicators. This year, make mosquito control easier and cheaper. Come by Holden Hardware on the square and get the Spartan Mosquito Eradicators.
Middle Tennessee football and basketball games are right here. This is Chip Walters on Rutherford County's Blue Raider Station.
MTSU Sports on WGNS. The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
You're tuned to WGNS, and with us from Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue, we have Brian Lowe. And how big of a part of your job is tied to education as far as educating the community, educating children about fire prevention?
Well, that's about 30% of what our division does. So, you know, public education, children, we have our, you know, our STEAM program. That's really our flagship program for that. Chandra Womack, Assistant Fire Marshal Womack, she heads that up. And if you have a child that is in elementary school, they probably know her. All the city schools, she'll work throughout the year to make sure that STEAM program is delivered to all the second graders. Science, technology, engineering, and math. I believe I got that right. So we'll look at some of the things that we do, and it's been approved by that, I believe, at Tennessee Board of Regents, that curriculum to go in. And I think we have them about 30 minutes each week for about 6 weeks to just go in and say, hey, here's something that we do at the fire service, and this is how it relates to science, or this is how it relates to engineering or math. And it's well received, and we have a chance to engage the children there and get some posters and poster contests, and actually whoever wins that poster contest, we'll pick them up in a fire truck, take them to breakfast, and deliver them to school in that fire truck. So
yeah. I can imagine the kids who get to do that, they're probably pretty excited.
It makes their day. So yeah,
I bet. Now, in the city of Murfreesboro, we have, I don't know how many schools now, but 9,000 plus students. So I mean, that's got to be, that's a lot of time.
It's quite a few. What is it? I think it's I'm sorry, and they would probably get on to me if I think it's 15 schools now. So roughly, you can figure however many second graders that is. I was thinking maybe one day, maybe 13, 14, 1,500.
Yeah, that's yeah. A lot of kids.
Yeah, it's a lot of contact hours. So yeah.
Yeah. I bet you get the craziest questions too from kids.
Yeah, well, it's, when I have the time to kind of sit in or pinch hit, there's it's not necessarily questions, as it's more stories, but it's okay. We enjoy, that's the lighter side of what we do, being able to get into the schools and speak with the children. So, yeah.
So as you're talking to them, are you also talking to the kids about, you know, what to do if there is a fire? The first thing you should do is, you know, fill in the blank.
Absolutely. And we teach the kids, we want them to work with their parents right on this. Those things that have been the same ever since I was a kid, get out, stay out, have a meeting place outside. Or go next door to call 911. All of those things that we teach our children to crawl low and smoke. No two ways out of your house. Those are all things that we're going to go over with those children. So,
as far as fire alarms here in the city of Murfreesboro, I know some are tied into security alarm systems, mm-hmm. and whatnot. Do you have to inspect those security alarms as they're being installed, or who does the permitting for all of those?
So, on commercial, that's part of that CO process. We will test every alarm point, every alarm that's going in. So when that building is handed over to the owner after it's built and all the fire department features are installed, it should be at 100%. And then the alarm companies will come in and test those points annually. And then if something's not working, they generally yellow tag that system, and that lets us know, hey, we need to follow up on this to make sure the alarms are being put back the way it should be. So
obviously there's a effort, and probably has been for years, to lessen the number of false alarm calls.
Yes. And it's getting better. Technology's helping with that. Sometimes we have smoke alarms or smoke detectors in places they shouldn't be. And so if we have a nuisance detector like that, and there's some opportunities for, say, for example, a smoke detector, if it's in the kitchen, that's not necessarily a good place for it if you're burning your food all the time, right? And so in a commercial setting, we can go in and maybe change that out to a heat detector, flame detector, or something like that in lieu of that smoke detector one, that building was still protected, but two, now it's not a nuisance for the chef, and he can burn his whatever it is he's cooking. So,
is that the type of thing that would be picked up during an inspection if it were a new restaurant about to open?
Well, if it wouldn't necessarily be picked up, I mean, the assistant fire marshals are good in that. They would probably say, hey, I see you have a smoke detector in the kitchen. That's probably going to cause you some problems. We may have to talk to the fire marshal and look at changing that out to a flame detector or something like that at some point. So,
but these different systems, I mean, these are all common knowledge now, I would say, among what, the builders?
Yes, the builders, the vendors, the contractors, whoever install that system. So you see a lot of sprinkler contractors branching out and doing both now, sprinkler and alarm systems. And to me, that goes hand in hand, that they can, one vendor can work on both. So, yeah.
Now, if anybody has any questions off the air, if they want to figure out I don't know how they could go about getting you to come out to maybe a private school to talk or something along those lines, how do they go about setting all that up?
Well, two ways. One, you can always call our administration number direct, 615-893-1422, or you can go online to our City of Murfreesboro webpage and go to fire department. And on the fire marshal's page, there is a special events request link there, and you can click on that, and it'll give you a really nice fillable form to fill out, and you hit submit, and that'll go directly to our assistant fire marshals and administrative aides. So,
but you're looking for the administrative office if you want to set that up.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, hey, it's been my pleasure. I appreciate you having us in.
Again, Brian Lowe with us today from Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue, and I guess we'll talk to you again in the near future.
Yes, sir, Scott. Thank you.
Time right now is 8:58. Stay with us. We do have more news coming your way next. In fact, we'll get you an update on everything happening with CBS Radio News right now.
CBS News Brief. A Christian girls camp confirms 27 campers and counselors are among the more than 80 people who died in catastrophic flooding in central Texas. Julia Hatfield watched another child slip away in Kerr County.
The hardest part was there was a little boy who started floating downstream, and he was screaming, asking for help, but there just wasn't anything anybody could do at that point.
Dozens remain missing. President Trump meets with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu at the White House in hopes of a Gaza ceasefire deal. The Carnegie Endowment's Aaron David Miller.
There's a better chance than ever now, since early this year, to actually reach another incremental interim deal.
Some campers in Idaho report seeing a man matching the description of a fugitive accused of killing his three young daughters. CBS's Steve Kathan.
One report said the family described the man as being 5'8 to 5'10, long ponytail and overgrown beard and mustache.
CBS News Brief. I'm Deborah Rodriguez.